Welcome again tonight. I'm Stacey Stevens with the Michigan Roundtable for Diversity and Inclusion. Yay! So how many of you are here because you have attended our first Friday Forum series at any point in time? Yay! Oh, wonderful, wonderful. So about half of you or so. Tonight is the first Friday of November, and so for the last 4 years, the Michigan Roundtable has been convening these monthly conversations on race in Detroit and in Metro Detroit. So how many of you who haven't been here knew that this was happening every first Friday? Okay, so some of you, and some of you didn't know and know now. So we have been having these community conversations on race, as I said, for the last 4 years, and we're going to continue them until we no longer have to talk about race. And we do this intentionally because we know there are not spaces where we can openly have dialogue about race, particularly in Metro Detroit. And when we talk about race, we talk about systems. We're talking about systemic and institutional racism and how it is played out in the communities that we live in and where we see the effects and the impacts of systemic racism. And so tonight's conversation is intentionally designed to talk about the issues around peace and violence and race and connecting those. And so tonight, while you're here, we are going to ask you to have dialogue with folks at the table that you're sitting with. And I think most of you, if you didn't take an agenda, we'll bring some around. But on the bottom of the agenda are these important values for open conversations about race. Some of the work that we do, we're very intentional about wanting to make sure that the spaces that we create are spaces where we can have safe dialogue about race. And so if you can just pay attention to those at your tables when you guys are in dialogue with each other. Now, we have this great opportunity. As I said, we have these conversations every month, and sometimes we're the only ones bringing people together, and sometimes we get lucky and we find partners, and sometimes partners find us. And in this situation, Michigan Radio found us, and they they'll talk a little bit about their how they came to the State of Opportunity work and all of that. But part of how they found us is rooted in another program of ours called Healing Stories. And so our first Friday forums are places where we bring people together every month to talk about race. And Healing Stories is another one of our programs that we have created to intentionally create spaces for people to tell their stories, people who are most impacted by the systematic and institutional racism in our communities, and for them to have that space to tell their stories, but then for people to be able to hear those stories and move towards action in a space of, how do I say this, thinking more about moving towards dismantling those systems, and so those stories being the sort of narrative change, the defining the change, rather than statistics and data and sort of that top down, but more from the bottom up. So we have this program called Healing Stories, and so tonight we're sort of merging both of these aspects of our work around creating spaces to dialogue about race, but then also creating the spaces for people who are most impacted by systemic racism to share their stories and work towards all of us working towards creating places to dismantle that systemic racism. So that's all I'll say. The final thing that I want to make sure is that you have a flyer, save the date for our next forum. It will be the first Friday of December, and you can grab those on your way out, too. And we are actually going to talk about race in America post-election 2016. So it's kind of up in the air right now, but we know the conversation around race isn't going to change. So join us next month. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Sarah Hewlett. I'm the senior editor at Michigan Radio. Like Stacey said, we've partnered with the Michigan Roundtable to be here tonight. Thanks, like Scott said, thanks to all of you for deciding to spend a Friday evening here. Tonight we're going to hear stories from people involved in anti-violence work, and we'll have time for some deeper discussion of those stories at your table. State of Opportunity, for anybody who doesn't know what that is Michigan Radio's reporting project, long-term reporting project on barriers to opportunity for low-income children. And if you heard recently Zach Rosen's wonderful documentary that spent a lot of time in this neighborhood, it's really a worthwhile listen about the kind of dedication that folks in Osborne and all around this city have put toward making their neighborhoods more peaceful. So we want to set the stage for these stories that we're going to hear first with a conversation about the roots of violence in Detroit and the kinds of community-led solutions that are being used to address that violence. So we want to welcome two Detroiters to the stage here who've spent a lot of time thinking about this topic. Lauren Hood is the founder of Deep Dive Detroit. It's an organization that creates safe spaces for uncomfortable conversations between different groups. She also is the director of the Live Six Alliance. Welcome, Lauren. And Frank McGee is the director of the Youth Initiatives Project at Detroit's Neighborhood Services Organization. Welcome, Frank. We're going to be asking some big questions, so we won't answer them all on this stage, but we hope it'll kind of serve as a jumping off point for discussions later on. So we're going to dive right in here. One of the topics that we wanted to tackle tonight is racial inequity and violence. There are lots of facets to the issues of violence in Detroit, and they have historical roots that reach back into the past. And a big part of that discussion has to do with the city's long history of racial inequity. I'd like both of you to talk a little bit about how that inequity is connected to the high rates of violence that we see in Detroit today. And I don't know who would like to start that conversation. Lauren, you've been volunteered.
Yes, by Frank. Thanks, Frank. I want to go first. I think that from what I have seen, a lot of the violence that happens today is because there is a group of people that is systemically left out of the mainstream economy. And I feel like the dominant narrative says that a certain group of people is just that way. But my thinking is that, my knowing is that no one chooses that unless they have to, when all the choices that are before you are bad choices. And you need to survive. You do what you need to do. So it's a response to being left out of an economy and still needing to make it, still needing to eat, still needing to live somewhere, still needing transportation to get to wherever you need to go. If it's not work, to wherever you need to go to maintain your life. But it's about being, it's a response to being left out.
Yeah, and there are some real policy choices that have been made that have driven the kind of situation that you're talking about, Lauren. Frank, what did you
Sure, and in many cases, these policy choices are being driven by those who don't even live in our city. And so we had to have a voice that has to be heard so that we can change those policies and make our community, make our neighborhoods, make our city more equitable with those around it. There are so many things that impact our children, and our children see what's not right, and they speak up about it, but in many cases, their voices are not heard. And so what I do, and when I look at this, I had to sit and listen and make sure I bridge that gap by having an opportunity for those kids to talk to, for example, Councilmember Scott Benson, or having our young people have the opportunity to have their voices heard, not just with the principal, but perhaps with the superintendent and higher up. But it has to start. If we're going to combat what we see as inequity in this area, we have to make sure that have a space for our youth to participate in the discussion.
Can I address something else you said too? And so many times the people making decisions about policies and processes that impact those groups have no personal experience with those groups of people. So in particular, I think about all the tables that I sit around for my day job doing community development work on the Northwest Side. Typically, I'm the only person at a table of like 12 decision makers who's from the Northwest Side or even from the city of Detroit. So you have to be thinking about the frame that people come to the table with. If you've never been exposed to people with certain kinds of challenges, the way you make decisions is going to be guided by some principles that point you in the wrong direction. So I'm always trying to advocate for more people that actually live in the city of Detroit to be making decisions about what happens in Detroit neighborhoods. But it's tough. It's really rare. And lots, I'm so thankful to be able to talk about race in a group of friendlies. Lots of times I'm on a stage and people will ask me to talk about race and I'm looking at a group of white guys with suits. And I know they're thinking, oh, Lord, here she goes. But I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk about race in a group of people that obviously want to talk about race. But it's hard in this redevelopment sphere that we're in Detroit as the culture is starting to shift and our landscape is starting to shift. Like, so many of the conversations are in all white rooms. And lots of times it's people that aren't even from the city that are doing the decision making.
And when you raise that issue in those rooms, what kind of response do you get?
It's interesting. Dead eyes a lot of times. And it's funny because a lot of philanthropy right now convenes conversations on like race and equity. So when you're at that panel discussion or that dialogue where you're allowed to talk about race and equity, everybody's really open to having the conversation and agrees it's important. But then when you take what you've heard in that session into like the decision-making table, and some of those same people who were at the thing talking about race and equity are at this decision-making table and they just don't show up. Like, what they learned over there, like, doesn't show up. And it's so hard to be the only one at the table who's thinking this way.
When both of you, when you watch TV stories, read it in the newspapers, hear on the radio, stories about violent crime in the city, what do you find is, if you engage with that material at all, what do you find is missing from those stories?
If I find out that a young man was walking from his house to a bus stop and he was shot and killed, but he was walking to a bus stop at 4 a.m, I think about the challenges of the transportation system because he has to leave early to get to work on time. When I hear about the young man who has to battle the weather and go to beyond 8 Mile, to find a job, the same applies. But I also realize that looking at the violence is just the tip of the iceberg. You dig down deeper and find out exactly what presented that situation. And it has a lot to do with the inequities we see in our city.
Yeah, I would second that. Again, it goes back to it being a response to something and not just, you know, an unguided action on the part of a certain group of people. So what's missing in the dominant narrative is an unpacking of the root causes. So when you see a group of people that is committing crimes, do the extra investigative work to figure out why. Have a conversation with people and be like, what were your choices that led you to make this decision? We need to get it more of what people are responding to, like, why are they doing these things? But no one ever asked that. There's an assumption that's just the way that group of people is. That isn't true.
If I find out the issues around domestic violence occurred in a particular area or a particular time period involving 18 to 29-year-old couples, I learn that's spiking for a reason. Domestic violence is actually increasing in that demographic. And so we have to position ourselves, provide the support networks for that. That's what we do on that side. But I look at it differently. I don't just react to, oh, this is terrible. I know that the resources that should be there are not there. And it's a symptom. What we're seeing is the outcomes of what was not there.
I think a lot about stress in communities where there are not great job options, not great transportation options, parents trying to figure out how to get their kids to school. How much do you think stress figures into this conversation, the stress of that kind of situation?
I think James Baldwin put it pretty well when he said at that time to be a Negro is to be in a constant state of rage, in a sense, because of what you see and what you experience. Why is this happening at this time when I should be further along? And so quite naturally, you know, that stress is an outcome of that, but there's an opportunity to address it by having our voices heard And so we had to be relentless in that pursuit.
Yes, I would agree. Having a platform to have your voice heard is really important. And feeling a genuine sense of inclusion in what's happening in your community. What I've noticed is I feel like I get asked a lot now because of mostly my day job, I guess, what my opinion is and what I think the challenges are in the neighborhood. I'm almost like tired of talking about my personal reflections on things. And I do the best I can to like pass the mic to people that don't get to speak that much.
That's right.
But really, there are people, and I used to be like an uncivically engaged person because I didn't think I had anything to say. I didn't think that my voice mattered. But after doing this work for a while, I was like, wait a minute. What have I been convinced into believing about myself and others like me? So I do the best I can to encourage people to speak their mind. You don't have to have big words. You don't have to always sound like a prolific speaker, but just speak your truth. Get the word out about what's really going on. The people that are inside the system doing that work aren't that smart. Once you peel back the layers, I'm like, you don't know any more than I do. Like, once you get in there and look around. So I'm just trying to hold the door open and show everybody, like, come on, we need more of us in here so that we can make decisions that affect us in the right way and solve the problems that we actually need solved and not the problems that somebody else has decided need to be addressed.
So tonight we're going to be hearing stories about how different people and organizations have worked to address violence in their own communities. Can you guys talk about why you think it's important to have solutions? You touched on this some already, Lauren, that come from the community that are not so top-down. Why is that so critical? Frank, maybe you want to start?
Sure. And since I'm the program director of the Youth Initiatives Project, and a lot of our work, the magic of our work, occurs in this building. I mean, this room, this gymnasium, was host to a lot of events that our youth actually planned to deal with the issue of unemployment. Youth unemployment is very high. And so for a number of years, they would have events, bring in resources and potential employers who would come out. Even though it's youth-driven, it's adult-facilitated. We made sure we helped facilitate those opportunities for them to push this through and make sure their peers had employment, and jobs and whatnot. But now we're looking at other issues where young people can have an actual opportunity to speak about the inequity in education. They're seeing that, and so they're pushing their mark. And so this venue again serves as an opportunity for them to have petitions that they create, signed by 1,100 of their peers from different parts of the city. Schools that will be rivals join together because of what they see as wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful statement. It has to come from the community, and when it comes from the community, it drives change. Those are the best type of movements.
I'll use a specific example. So in the community I'm working in on the northwest side, when the powers that be are talking about making the neighborhood safer, the solution is always to increase police patrols or increased security patrols. So there are two universities up there, and the universities are working to get their public safety to be able to expand their presence in the neighborhood. In my mind, that increases the stress that you were talking about. So from the perspective of someone from the outside, it's like, yeah, give them more security. What I hear on the ground is that people feel safer when they know each other. And I can take that directly back to my childhood on the northwest side. Like when you know everybody on the street, you feel safe. It's really weird that my 12-year-old self felt very safe walking down Pinehurst at Margarita, but my 44-year-old self would feel terrified. And there have been some things that changed in the neighborhood, but that 12-year-old me, like, I knew somebody at least like every other house, so I never felt like I was in danger. Yeah. And I feel like increased community connections make a place safer. So I had a community meeting like a month ago, and this woman was like, I feel safe walking down my street because I know everybody. Nobody gonna do anything to me. And I was like, that's the thing right there. When you know the people in your community, you aren't just a target or a mark, you are Sheila. So you are less likely to have something happen to you. So in my mind, improving security comes from just people knowing each other, people being more civically engaged. I don't know what happened. I feel like 80s, 90s, people in communities knew each other a little bit better, but now it's a little different, maybe as populations in the neighborhood start to change. And it's not every neighborhood. I shouldn't generalize like that. Let me just talk about my neighborhood on the northwest side. But I feel like if we can get back to that space where more people knew each other, people relied on each other, people had each other's back. Like if you went out of town, people would watch your house for you. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of just little things that come from people knowing each other that is, it's a better means of making a place safer than just adding more security.
Exactly. Go ahead, give it up. That's right. In fact, just to piggyback off the importance of knowing each other, imagine a guy who's 18 years old, about to turn 19, being told that he's not going to graduate because he doesn't have this, he doesn't have that. Yet he goes to school here at Osborne, but lives on the far northwest side in Brightmoor. Whoa, 3 buses to get here to this building because he knew he would be treated with dignity and respect. Even though people said, well, that's a gang member, that really didn't define him. He had a purpose to graduate. Even though there was a terrible weather period, they call it the polar vortex or whatever it was a terrible time, he still took the buses and he got here. We made sure we got him home. But the community, you all need to know, because of that, because of the fact that he knew people here, not just me, but other people who showed him love, he was able to get the tutoring and mentoring he needed to get through that tough time of his life and graduate. He graduated when others said it was not going to happen. That sense of community was in this building. And he discovered that he never knew he could do it. And he took that confidence and advocated in a wonderful meeting, a forum that the President's My Brother's Keeper initiative launched. He spoke up about his experience and changed the mindset of folks up at the top of DPS. That is the spirit of community. That's what we're talking about.
Just to stay on the subject a little bit, I want you to talk a little bit more about the role that youth in our communities can play in addressing this issue of violence, especially. Who needs to listen more, and how can we create those opportunities for youth to weigh in on this?
Well, I can tell you that's a no-brainer. We need to listen more. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. That's it. Mm-hmm. We go ahead. Yeah, we need to listen more.
What does that look like, though?
And that looks like what you see tonight, where even though you may, if you look around, some of our youth are here. They're listening. Yeah, right. Go ahead. Go raise your hand. All the youth, stand up. Let's see you. Come on.
Woo!
All right. All right. They're here.
Yeah.
They're listening. They're sitting over at that table. Some of my students are here. But what they're going to do is they're going to take this and they're going to do something along the lines of that's youth driven and on their own, but they have to learn. What also has to be seen is patience. Our role is not to dictate as adults how it should be, but also be there to coach and support and help them to achieve their goal. It's not going to be as perfect. It's not going to be a straight line. They're going to zig and zag, but eventually they're going to get to their finished product. Who would have thought that a chief of police would sit down with a group of teenagers and have a press conference once a year telling folks about the urgency about gun violence? They had to do that because several of their friends got killed. Who would have thought that the director of the bus transportation system in this city would give up an hour of his time to meet with these kids and show them all the issues that's still going on with repairing those buses 3 years ago, because there's no seven mile bus line just wasn't working for them. They were going to get into school late. Because those kids spoke up and met with this individual, Dan Dirks, the bus lines were improved. He told them what was going to happen. It's not perfect. Guess what? He still checks in with them. Well, that has a lot to do with the fact that they advocated. But where did they learn that? By participating in events quite like this. We have to create simply a space for them to do that.
We're getting ready to transition to our storytellers, But Lauren, because I know that you sort of work in this area, I wanted you to talk a little bit about how you think personal stories can help drive change and shape the direction of this city.
It has been my personal experience that when someone can personalize a story, it has a more direct impact. I'll use an example from today. So I facilitated a dialogue for a group of fellows. Half of the fellows are black native Detroiters. The other half of the fellows are white from the suburbs and from other cities and other states. And the discussion today centered around police brutality. And when we did our final wrap-up, everyone went around and said the thing that impacted them most in the conversation. And by the way, one of the guys who was there, his father was a policeman, so that's how we got on this conversation. He was like, okay, black people, because that was the part of the discussion. We let the white folks ask the black folks some questions. And he asked, explain to me the negative relationship between police and black men. And he's like, my dad's a great guy. He's been a cop for this many years. I know his cop friends, and they're all really good people, and they think they're doing the right thing. Like, explain to me this dynamic between the black men and police. And so of the five black men that were in the room, each of them had multiple stories about being harassed by police. And just that experience of him listening to them tell their stories changed his perspective and that of others. There were at least like 10 other people in this room out of 40 that cited those conversations and insights as the most impactful part of today's like 4-hour dialogue. It was just being able to listen to people that they know and care about, explain their specific interactions with police, opened up a whole new world of thinking for the white people who sometimes were from small towns, who the only black people they had ever known or had only seen were on the news and had no firsthand interaction with black males. But seeing people in their cohort that they knew, that they cared about, tell those stories, it changed their whole perspective. So I feel like that's just one example, but putting a face to some statistics, like saying this percentage of black men is killed by police, like, okay, that's a number. But if you can have people that you know, and you know their names, and you know their family, and you know other people they care about, you start to care about it, and it appears different to you. So that in those instances, the personal story is so important.
Thanks to you both. We're going to bring you back up here for our wrap-up at the end of the storytelling and discussion. Right now, we've got some folks who are going to share their stories about the anti-violence work that they've done as individuals in their communities and with the institutions that they work with. First up, we have longtime urban peace activist Tafari Brent.
Good evening. Radical love. Radical love. It's funny, when we talk about peace, really do we want to affix the catalyst and the instrument for the creation, establishment, and development of peace, which for me, for my social lens, is love. But I'm talking about a different kind of love, you know. It's a radical love. It's that love never fails, love conquers all type of love. Love is kind, love is gentle kind of love. That kind of love that'll make you want to give your life for somebody. Radical love. For me, that's what peace looks like. So my story, I have many. I really wanted to draw upon one from my Clementine Barfield's So Sad days, but she tells those stories so much better than me, so I wouldn't dare tread in that territory. But the one I wanted to use today is a very personal one. I'm vividly reminded of a time 4 or 5 years ago when at that time my wife and my children, we were coming home from church. It's interesting, my pastor, Dr. Wendell Anthony, was preaching on love that particular day. And as I walked up to my home, to my front door, I saw that my door was open. Now, mind you, I'm a North Ender. I live on the North End. I love the North End. I eat, sleep, breathe, and drink the North End. I am North End through and through. My granddaddy's store was on the North End, Brent's Market, right there in Horton and Bobie. And then my Uncle Sidney's store was on Oakland Boulevard. I mean, we are North End true and true. Emma Brent used to feed the children and provide lemonade and Kool-Aid for the kids as they played in the streets. And all the pimps, the players, and the hustlers used to come to Brent's Market and talk there and meet there and convene there. Everyone felt safe in front of the Brent home, in front of Brent's Market on Horton Street in Bobie. And everyone felt loved. Everyone felt appreciated. No one was judged. Everyone felt equal on the North End on Horton and Bobie. I, too, stay on Horton and Bobie. And right next door to my granddaddy's house, 503 Horton. I'm on 521 Horton. So 3-4 years ago, I'm walking up to my home with my wife and my children, and I see someone had broken into this Brent home. It's the same home where the brother who provided 150 jobs for young people every summer, the same home where the brother who was a community reintegration specialist for Flip the Script Goodwill had provided employment for over 200 black men who came home from prison. It's the same home where the brother was the community outreach specialist for the North End Governance Board and built block clubs and patrols regularly. It's the same home. They broke into my home. They broke into a Brent home. So I come to the door. I see my house had been broken into. I walk through the house just to see if there's anyone in there, but I know it was daytime. They had to have been gone. I see the back door had been kicked in or kicked out. Went upstairs, saw my doors were kicked in. I saw one door was off the hinges. Saw that my TVs were broken. All of my jewelry had been stolen. My Timberlands had been taken. My Air Force Ones were gone. They just took everything. And I can tell it was young people because I had a laptop over here and a desktop here. They ain't even touched that stuff. They just came. They just took my PlayStation. You know, every grown man got to have PlayStation, right? So they took my PlayStation, my laptop, my iPad, and took my Timberlands and my Air Force Ones, you know. And it hurt me. It hurt me. I was more so hurt than I was angry because I felt violated, not because they had just broken into my home, but because I was one who served and put in work in that community. That's my community. Everyone knows Tafuri. How you gonna break into the brother who feeds you, who has taught you how to read, who has housed you and clothed you and given you opportunity and employed you and prayed with you? How do you break into my home? That hurt me. Hurt me. I wasn't angry. I was hurt. I felt betrayed. We're talking about radical love. So the old man in me wanted to do some very bad things to whoever did this. I must admit, there was a time in my life where we would go find these individuals and do great harm to them and maybe even their families. But that ain't radical love. It was radical love that transformed that person. But that ain't love to go do that. So the first thing I decided to do, I said, well, let me call some people because I'm going to get whoever did this. I'm going to find out who did this because I just want to ask a couple questions, not to mention the fact I want to get my stuff back. And I ain't calling the police, although I've worked with the police. I wasn't calling the police because I don't believe in locking brothers up for taking material things. Radical love. But I want to know who did this. I needed to know who did this to me. Who did this to us? Who did this to themselves? So I called a few brothers who I know who I knew wasn't scared, who were courageous, strong brothers who had been through some things. I called some brothers who were formerly incarcerated, who had, you know, been through some challenges and some trials and some struggles, who could speak the lexicon of the streets, who understands how to interact with young brothers, how to approach young brothers, assuming it was brothers, come to find out it was brothers. But I needed somebody who wasn't scared. I don't need cowards around me when you're doing this street work, when you're doing this peace work. You can't be a coward doing this peace work. Cowardice and peace and fighting for peace or organizing for peace or working for peace don't go together, because oftentimes the elements that you have to interact with in order to create a culture, climate, and consciousness for peace aren't very peaceful. So I called some brothers who I knew was about it. I called Yusuf Shakur. I called Raphael B. Johnson. I called Derek Blackman. Yusuf showed right up, because he's zone 8, I'm zone 2, right down the street. Raphael Johnson showed right up in his suit and his shoes, took his blazer off, of course, jumped out the car. Man, what's up? What we going to do? How you want to handle this, Brother Tafuri? Called Brother Blackman. Brother Blackman couldn't make it at that particular time, but he constantly called to check on me, and I found out just really a few months ago why he did not show up, because he was so hurt by it, because he had done so much work for me in that community. He was really concerned about how at that time he would have responded to the situation. So he thought it was in the best interest of us and those individuals to sit back and collect himself and think about it, because it hurt him as well. He shared that with me recently. We went out. The first thing we did, I thought about how this could have happened. And it dawned on me, before I went to church that morning, there were a group of young men who walked down the street. And they stopped me at my gate, at my front gate, and said, Brother Tafuri, what's up, man? I said, what's up? There's about five of the brothers, five young brothers. It was like 10 o'clock in the morning. I thought it was strange they would be walking in groups at that time morning. That shows you how disconnected and detached I am, because I knew, you know, as I look upon it retrospectively, they were casing. Right. But I wasn't thinking like that at the time, because when you transform, your mind changes. Right. So I remember the young brothers who had stopped me and talked to me. And strangely, they would ask me about employment and work. And, hey, man, we need some help. Brother Tafuri, can you look out for us? I said, OK, sure, brother. Get back with me. In fact, Devious, give me your number and I'll get back with you. It was five brothers: Devious, Durrell, Darius, DeAndre, all of them named D. Right. Three brothers. And it was two other guys, Henry and another guy, who was with them. But it's five brothers, all of them named D, mama named Tamika Davis, stay right down the street from me. So that's the first place I went. I said, well, these were the last brothers I had seen, and they were together, and we know when cats do B&Es, that's how they operate. So we walked down the street, knocked on the door, me, Yusuf, Raphael, no fear, and said, are your sons, and Miss Davis, how you doing, Sister Davis, are your sons here? One of the young brothers came out. We had a real firm, strong, loving conversation with the brother. He didn't want to talk because he wasn't going to snitch. The next brother came out. We had a real strong, firm conversation with this brother. He began to give up a little bit more information. Another young man came out. This wasn't a brother, but a friend. Raphael took this brother, isolated him, put his arm around him. It was a hard hug, too. I'm like, Ralph, don't hurt him. He took the young brother, walked him down the street. Took him down to the corner. You can see him serving court right there on the corner, talking to the brother, you know, as if to say, man, how dare you violate this brother, man? You know what he does. You need to bring this man stuff back. We're not going to tolerate that. Yusuf, forever being the peacemaker, believe it or not, Yusuf took another brother, took him to the other side of the porch. So at this time, Yusuf had a brother. Raphael had a brother, because you got to get them alone, because they won't talk in front of each other. But when you catch them by themselves, they got a lot to say. So all three of us talked to him. And I'm telling you, within 15 minutes, you should tell me if I'm lying, within 15 minutes, brother came around the corner as if someone in the back room had made a call. Brother walks around the corner with two garbage bags full of my stuff. He walks around the corner. We went up and we hugged the brother. We embraced the brother. We let the brother know, brother, we're not going to convict you. We're not trying to incarcerate you. We're not trying to lock you up. We're not going to do harm with you, brother. We just want our things back. And most importantly, we want to know, what do we need to help you put yourself in a better situation so you don't feel compelled to go around and violate your own people, especially people who care about you? What do you need? So what do we do? Once I got all my things back, and there were some other events that occurred shortly thereafter, because some of my stuff was in an abandoned car right outside of my house in the trunk. All my Timberlands was in the trunk of the car. And the brother came and told me where they were, and he went there and he popped the trunk. Said, "Brother, hey man, I saw somebody put these boots in the trunk of this vehicle." Now, you know, anyone know I saw? He was a part of it, right? He put them there, you know. So I went and got my boots, and I saw the young brothers a couple days later, and it kind of bothered me. I said, "What could we do better to meet their immediate needs?" This is radical love. At that time, I was community reintegration specialist for Flip the Script Goodwill, the premier holistic black male development program in the country. So here we are sitting on this great resource. How dare we not offer this resource to these brothers? After all, this is what Flip the Script was made for, to help black men flip their script. So as opposed to locking the brothers up, we invited three of the five brothers up to the Flip the Script program and enrolled them in Flip the Script Base. Two of the brothers, within a year and a half, two of the brothers got their GED. They got their, one of the brothers is to this day working on his diploma because he was a little younger. Two of the brothers got their driver's license fixed. And one of the brothers got some things removed from his record because he had some B&Es and some nonviolent crimes. The key here is that we went to the brothers exactly where they were, in love, not in fear, not looking to punish them for the things that they did, but to encourage them and lift them up and become instruments of transformation and salvation and restoration for the young brothers. To this day, I talk to these brothers. I talked to Devious 2 weeks ago. I said, "Brother, what are you doing?" He said he's working at a stamping facility. Another one of the young men, his name is Henry. We got him a job right around the block from my house at Parks Barbecue, and to this day, he's working at North End Stamping. The brother told me just a week ago, "Brother Shafuri, I never ever broke into another house after that because I'm forever grateful that you didn't harm me or you didn't lock us up." Talking about restorative justice. Talking about radical love. So just because you broke into my house, that don't mean I got to break your life. Because those are just things. How much more is a black life worth? How much more did that opportunity of grace and mercy, right, mean to those young brothers in regards to them recognizing that there are those who love them in spite of the mistakes that they make, who can look beyond the mistakes and look beyond their deficiencies and their flaws and their failures? That I love you because you're my brother, because you're my son, because you look just like me. And didn't nobody kill me and lock me up when I was just like you? Somebody gave me radical love and transformed my life. So how dare I not extend that same kind of love to you? So for me, that is what peace looks like. Loving even when it hurts. Loving even when you're victimized by the object of your love. Loving those who you may fear. Loving those who you may be angry at. Loving those who at some point in time may not particularly care for you, but yet you still see God and goodness and greatness in them in spite of their immediate reality and how they may act, recognizing that their life is a book and it's not just a chapter. Radical love is what peace looks like to me.
Thanks, Itafari. Hello. Next up, we have Tamika Gaines. Tamika calls herself a social justice sergeant, and she is the founder of Social Media for Social Justice.
Good evening. My name is Tamika Gaines, and I am a social justice sergeant. I was just born this way. nothing extra special about me because each and every one of you have the same things about you that I have about me. It's just that no one has tapped into it. We all heard about the civil rights movement. Some of us was even there. But guess what? It hasn't stopped. It's just that we stopped trying to duplicate what was proven to work. So what I did was I created social justice via social media. So if any people in here are savvy, I would love for you to use a hashtag this evening, and it would say social justice via social media. What does that really mean? Little story about Tamika Gaines. Once again, I was just born this way. Some people call it defiant. I call it standing up for what is right. Many times we see things and we never speak up. And this is why our world is so plagued with situations such as even Donald Trump. We can blame ourselves for that too, because we don't speak up when social injustices take place. I can't even think of the date, but let's talk about what happened. On Mac at 75, there was a gas station incident. I just simply was going to pick up my son from school. He attended, at that time, Benjamin Carson School of Science and Medicine. And while I was there, I was going to pick him up, and I needed some gas. Simple task, right? Got off work, realized I needed some gas before I picked up my son. I was going to go use my credit card. So I went to the gas pump. Price is already high at that Shell. But I go anyway to go and do that. Well, while I'm there, the machine doesn't work. So I have to actually go inside the gas station. I'm one of those people who do. I'll pay the extra because I don't really want to go in the gas station. But I go inside, and there's a line. Unfortunately, we have some of the students that attend Benjamin Carson School of Science and Medicine who were instructed not to go to the gas station. They've snuck over there, and they are over there. And then there's also a young black man there. We'll say he's 32 years old. He's in there, and he gets into an altercation with one of the guys that's of Chaldean Arab descent. So they get into an altercation. He's cussing. He calls him a name, and he pulls out a gun and threatens him. He shows him the gun to threaten him. Mind you, there's a line. I need you to visually see this. There's a line, black gentleman, 32, three children from across the expressway. And then there's me waiting to get service so I can get some gas in my car. So this transaction takes place. These young people are here. He puts him out and tell him he gonna shoot him or whatever. Next thing I know, the young ladies, they must be used to this because they weren't moved. I was just totally disturbed by this experience. They were unmoved, which lets me know that we failed them. They should never tolerate nor expect that type of behavior, but they just dealt with it. So lo and behold, thank you for the applause. Lo and behold, when it was their turn to put their stuff on the counter, the guy was still frustrated and having a conversation with the other guy in the back, still frustrated, yells at the young ladies and cusses them and calls them names. And they didn't flinch. Why didn't they flinch? Can somebody in the audience tell me why those young ladies didn't flinch, wasn't moved, wasn't upset? Because this is a cultural issue, and we allowed that to happen. We failed our children. However, we don't have to, just because we fail once don't mean we have to continuously be failures, because that was the birth of social justice via social media. So what did I do? I went and I put my, I went to go pay for my gas. I asked for a receipt and everything. I was talked to aggressively. They didn't know who they was talking to. They didn't know this was Tamika Gaines. It was a wrong day for this behavior. So what? I was upset with myself because I left my phone in the car. So I ran back to my car when I got my receipt, took a picture. Anybody can guess what I did once I took that picture? I posted it on Facebook. Oh, my God. You don't even know the power you have with social media. I posted that on Facebook, and to quicken this story, 4 weeks in a row, I did not walk by myself as we shut down that gas station. It was Tafori was there. oh my God, it was where Yusuf was there, Sam Riddle was there, all because Tamika Gaines, nobody of great essence, just Tamika Gaines, posted on Facebook the offense. It took place, took a picture. People called that gas station day and night. People from that wasn't from Michigan. We have power. Let's use it. We must use our power. We must stop failing our children. So I ask you to join social justice via social media, because we can still march without walking. We can use social media. We can do this. If you agree with me, give me a hand. Thank you. That boosted my ego a little bit. Since I know I got extra time and I tied that story up really quick, I still want to share another story with you. And that is how important it is for us to really act. And when I say act, you need to actually take action on what's going on in our community. It is very key. Prime example, the excellent way that I met Tafori and I met Yusuf and Raphael Johnson is that my son was asked by Raphael to walk with him. He says, could you walk with us? We're going to, there was a, I want to get the age right, an 80-plus-year-old woman was raped. And they asked my son, well, I'm a single parent, so my son going to be out in the streets? Nah, that wasn't going to happen. So I decided, instead of saying no to my son experiencing that opportunity to be with all men, I said, I'm going with him because I need to watch him because I'm nervous. But, okay, we went, and I became the first woman to be out there with the men, knocking on doors. I saw all kind of things. So don't be limited because you're a woman either, because you too can get out here and walk these streets and pass out flyers. I mean, I was on the bullhorn. You know, I didn't even realize I was supposed to be scared. That's how I was. I just was around a whole bunch of men that was serious about fighting against crime. And so we just need us to join together as a community. We can fight crime. I love what I heard here on the stage when they said, the best way to fight crime is to get to know your neighbors. That is so true. When you feel safe, I am so serious. I had no clue that I was in danger out there in those streets. I walked those streets day and night, cold, hot. It didn't matter because I wanted a change. And all I'm asking you to do is be a part of the change. Join the movement. Create a movement. Be a movement. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, so we're going to move to dialogue at the table. So Gina is an intern of ours from Wayne State University. And then in the back, we have Darren, Tamim, and Hannah. They're going to hand out. Gina, give them some of the papers to hand out to the tables. The three interns that I just... when I said Darren, Tamim, and Hannah, they're part of our 14-month paid internship that we have for youth from the age of 16 to 21. We have a 14-month paid internship where these young folks come together to understand and learn about social justice and how to engage and become youth organizers in their community. So three of our 12 interns are here tonight with us engaging in this work. So they're handing out a sheet. Hand out multiple sheets to the tables, guys. There's 50 of them, so I think there's more than 50 people in here, but you can at least put four per table. And if anybody in the room is from Matrix, the lights have been going down, so can we try to get them back up? That would be great. Thank you. And then at your tables, so it says on the sheet, after the first pod of stories, so that was the first pod, there's three questions there. In the interest of time, just choose one question to talk about at your table. Think about, make sure that there's somebody at the table that sort of can act as a pseudo-facilitator, somebody that makes sure that everybody's voice at the table is being heard, and if it wants to be heard, and that the... sort of values for having the community discussion that are on your agenda are adhered to too. So that would be the role of the facilitator, just making sure. And this may sound kind of weird because we think we all might be in a space and we all might be like-minded, but because we're like-minded, this is my coworker Yusuf says this all the time, doesn't necessarily mean we're like-valued. And so let's hold to these values and keep that space open. So go to it. April, how much time do we have for this? 15 minutes, yeah. So choose the one question that sort of resonates with the table, and we'll have about 15 minutes, and then we'll start with our second pod of stories. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I hope you've had some good conversations at your tables. We're going to start our second round of storytelling, and I'm going to bring up Josh Pelt. Josh grew up in Detroit, and he graduated from University Prep High School. He's also an alum of the Neighborhood Service Organization's Youth Initiatives Project. So give it up for Josh.
Good evening, everybody. Again, my name is Josh Pelt, alumni of YIP. I'm from the east side of Detroit, Kelly Road and Maross area. I came up in a single-parent household and was very furious and angry about it. Didn't understand why my dad wasn't around. A lot of trouble in school. I gave my mom a hard time, long story short. So just this past summer, I coached PAL football, and I had this one kid in particular. And he had such a personality. Before it even surfaced, I can see the attitude in him, the anger. And I had one incident. We were at football practice. I coached with the Michigan Warriors at Ball Duck Park is where we practice at. We were scrimmaging the game. His team was down at the time, and he was upset. We had a new kid that's never played sports before. He throws him the ball and doesn't catch the ball. He costs him the game, and he exploded. A parent tried to calm him down, and he was every curse word in the book to the parent. I came to embrace him to try to calm him down. And he just crying just fiercely. And it was just, I don't want you to talk to me. Leave me alone. Leave me alone. And we couldn't calm him down. I didn't understand what it was. A lot of the coaches wanted to give up on him. They was, leave him alone. He's done. We're not going to let him play on this team. We're not going to accept that kind of behavior. But for me being having similar issues, my first thought was not to give up on him. So we coach games on Saturdays. We had a similar incident again. He's in the game. He makes a mistake and he explodes in the game. We pulled him out of the game and he takes his helmet off. He tosses it. He's cursing me and another one of my coaches. I'm every curse word in the book. And I'm telling him, hey, come on, I'm trying to calm him down, pull him to the side. We're trying to embrace him and talk to him, and it's no talking to him. Now, I can't talk to him aggressively on the field. We got PAL officials out here. We got parents. Everybody's looking. His mom walked out on the field, and as we were asking him, who are you talking to? Like, just where are you getting this behavior? His mom told us not to talk to her son. Leave my son alone. That's my baby. Y'all don't talk to him like that. So I'm baffled at the moment because we never cursed at him. We never said anything wrong to him. We were trying to calm him down. But at the same time, as coaches, sometimes we get aggressive. He threw everything off. He's crying. He's telling us we done. He even squared up with my head coach as if he was going to fight with him. So My head coach is furious. He's done. He actually left the team. I think he missed about 3 or 4 games. He missed 3 or 4 games. We allowed him to come back. Although a lot of people didn't agree to it, they didn't want him there. I seen something special in him. He's very talented. My last game of the season, I approached him and I told him, man, it's something in you. Although you have this anger, you don't want to open up. He really doesn't talk with his teammates. He's real closed in. I told him, I see something in you. You remind me a lot of myself. And I asked him to exchange numbers with me and let's stay in contact after this football season still. The look in his eyes looked like, is he crazy? After all the disrespect I've given him, but it also, the look in his eyes was as if that's what he was looking for, somebody to give him special attention. A week later after that, he texts me. He texts me and he just said, Coach, I'm getting out of school. I'm getting ready to go skating. It was a random text. And I'm looking at the text message like, okay. But at the same time, it was him opening up. He just wanted to talk. He just making conversation. A week after that, he texts me telling me he's getting ready to try out for the basketball team. He wants me to come watch him try out. He wants me to be at his games. What I got out of it was, after so many people were shutting him out, he finally had somebody to open up to him and embrace him. Come to find out, his father was murdered at a young age, and he was angry. He's angry about it. He doesn't understand why he doesn't have his dad around. So it made me want to be even closer to him. Keon sent me his grades last week. He has all A's and B's. Like I said, he's trying out for the basketball team. I texted him earlier this week and asked him to come to church with me. He's excited about coming to church with me, and he's supposed to be going to church with me this weekend. But just to see the transition of you closing out and your anger, sometimes we need somebody to just reach out to us instead of pushing them off. I had 3 kids earlier this summer, got in this altercation. They were sitting around, and one of the kids ended up, they were on my football team, and one was 13, one was 14. 13-year-old, their best friends, he shot his friend, killed him. So I didn't want to have to see another situation like that, so I brought him in. I feel like, bring him under your wing. He needed a big brother. He needed a father figure in his life. And so far, it's looking good. So I'm happy that someone has allowed him to open up and give himself to somebody. And I'm eager to see what else he has in him. So that was my story.
Thank you, Josh. A colleague of mine at Michigan Radio who works for the State of Opportunity Project likes to do these stories that he calls One Person Can Make a Difference. And I just love that we have so many of those one persons in this room right now. It's really great. Next up, we've got Otis Bellinger. He's the assistant director of the Matrix Center and runs the teen mentoring and programming for the center.
How's everybody doing? Can somebody can y'all hear me? Okay. Uh-oh. All right. Can you all repeat after me? Do something. Y'all don't sound like y'all want to do nothing. Do something. Be something. Let me say it again. Do something. Be something. I would like to introduce you to 2 people. As you see, it's only one of me on the stage. Oh, and a Robert Redford lookalike. But let me introduce you to two people who meant something big to me. I'm only going to be on here for 5 minutes. This is my Uncle Greg. Now, if my father walked in here right now, I wouldn't know him. Don't know what he looked like, don't know what he smelled like, know nothing about him. My last name is Bellinger, but it'll probably stop after me because I have a daughter. My Uncle Greg taught me something. He said that one day you will grow up and you will have a wife and kids. And when you have a wife and kids, do not duplicate the same thing that your father did to you. So I just put it in my heart that if the Lord blessed me with children, he gave me three daughters, that I would never, ever duplicate the fatherlessness and the pain that I was shown. Now, he also told me that, you know what? You're going to get a wife. Well, you know, I'm on the second one. One out of two ain't bad. Okay. All right. Can y'all say thank you, Uncle Greg? I know that's kind of weird to some of y'all because he did, but he's a good guy. My Aunt Brenda, can y'all say hi, Aunt Brenda? Now, Aunt Brenda taught me, you know, I used to stutter all the time. So I would have to hit my leg every time I talked. I mean, so I would come to school and I would say something, I have to hit my leg. So she said, boy, I'm going to give you Aunt Brenda's version without the curse words. Bleep, 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 bleep. Bleep, 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 bleep. You know what? I can't even give y'all her version, so let me take you mine. So she would say, one day, you're going to speak at the White House. I mean, you're going to go to the White House. Something big and special going to happen for you. So I'm looking at her like, you mean the White House, you know, the neighborhood? She's like, no, the one in Washington. And actually, in May, myself, Brother Tafari, who was up here, and about 80 other men around the country did go to the White House in May of this year. But let me tell you what she did. She would, because they would send me to these speech pathologists. And I couldn't get along with them. I didn't like them. So she would put me in front of a mirror, right? And she had a purple bag. How many of y'all know what the purple bag is? Crown Royal up in this. So she had the purple bag. So you know what? She would sip and talk, sip and talk. So what she would do is say, talk slowly. And every time I got excited, she would hit my back, right? How I knew the Crown Royal was finished, because she'd take a break. But anyway, that's another thing. So what would happen is that, but when I said do something, be something, she said that one day, you also got to give back. So at age 12, I'm working on about 2 minutes. At age 12, I told myself that if the Lord ever blessed me to get out of my neighborhood, Dexter Davison, if you know about that neighborhood, it's not the best, that you got to do something, you got to be something. So you got to help somebody. How many of us know that we must help somebody? Okay, so the thing about it, you get blessings that way, but not just that, it's the right thing to do. So at age 12, I said that one day I'm going to start a program. And I want to work with all young boys, particularly males of color, who have that fatherless void in them, who know what it's like to say these words every day. I know a lot of young brothers say these words, why didn't he want me? And they don't know the full story. So they're angry. Like the brother said, they're angry. They don't know. And who do they take it out on? Who do they take it out on? So, you know, and I'm working on about 30 seconds. So what I did is that I didn't want to just talk about the problem. I didn't want to just whine. I didn't want to just come to a bunch of events. I don't want to just come to a bunch of conferences. I said it got to be some face-to-face. So in 1991, I started a program called Building Better Men. And we believe that early funeral home processions and prisons were never made for black males. Colleges, trade schools, entrepreneurship were made for black males. Now, we said that also we're going to do this program despite of. So if we don't get any funding, we still going to do it. If things don't go right, we're still going to do it. And to this day, 25 years later, we're here. The Matrix Center, that's how I got here. I was over here volunteering, helping some kids. And for some reason, that gentleman right there, Mr. Brown, offered me a job. I was like, damn. I mean, no, I'm sorry. So, you know, I mean, I can eat, y'all. Can y'all clap for that? I can eat. And then our other coworker, Ms. Zena Crossan, she's here. Raise your hand, Ms. Zena. So there's great things happening at the Matrix Center. Please feel free to contact myself, Ms. Zena, Mr. Brown. We got a lot of things going on here that benefits the community. I'll end it with this. We look at Matrix Center as the Sam Club of Human Services. God bless you.
Thank you, Otis. Okay, we have our last speaker coming up. Yusuf Shakur is a neighborhood organizer. He is a man who practices radical love, and he is the co-director of programs here at The Matrix. I'm sorry, here, sorry, getting confused. At the round table, co-director of programs at the round table.
Thanks. What up, though? How y'all feel? Good, y'all heard some incredible stories? That's what's up, man. For these stories to take place, we have to be centered and rooted somewhere. So for the story or stories I'm going to share with you tonight, as a result of the community that I live in, everybody that knows Yusuf know I'm from Zone 8. That's where I'm rooted at. When I think about stories, I think about particularly one day pulling up in front of my mother's house, and I get out and I look and I see it down at the corner, and the police have five young black males with their face on the ground, because they were shooting dice. And everybody else in the neighborhood is just walking right by them, as this is a routine thing, as if this is normal to have a group of black men and their face in the ground. Now, I only can imagine how they feel, the anger, the distrust, the bitter that's boiling inside of them. Because when the police leave, you know who they're going to release that on, right? Not on the police. On each and every one of us that walked right by them. So I made it my business to sit on the car. I didn't say nothing to the police. I didn't disrupt them or anything. I just observed. And as I observed, one of the cops said, yeah, we about to take this piece of shit away. He found a bag of weed on him. I'm like, he ain't a piece of shit. Like, what you mean he ain't a piece of shit? I'm like, he ain't a piece of shit. He a member of our community. I don't agree with his behavior or some of his decisions, but I'm not about to throw him away. You know, this is, you know, the result of why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I say, yo, boss is a piece of, no, I say something about somebody he worked with is a piece of shit. And he's like, what you mean? I'm like, your boss and on down is a piece of shit. And it was an easy way to how to insult him without insulting him. And learning how to do those things, but what was the most powerful thing about that experience, when one of the young men walked, got up, he just said, thank you. We didn't hug, we didn't shake hands. He just felt a certain way because of someone stood there and observed and fought for them in a way that protected and respected their dignity. And that's what's important about peace. For peace to exist in our community, we have, like, we talk about peace as this abstract thing. You know, people want peace, but how do we interact and develop and orchestrate peace in our community? And that was one way. Or it was another time in 2010, attending the U.S. Social Forum. And there was this white college student saying, well, Yusuf, I want to interview you. I'm like, sure, you can interview you. Like, where can I interview you? I'm like, well, you come to Zone 8. you can interview you in my neighborhood. And again, like most black neighborhoods, there's not a lot of white people in your neighborhood. So they, when they come in your neighborhood, they kind of stick out like a sore thumb. And I'm looking out my window and I see a car, I see a white, you know, some white people in there, so I automatically, like, that's them. And I look out the window again, I see some commotion, like, what the hell going on? What happened was somebody tried to rob her, tried to snatch her purse, and her father's with her, and her father came to her rescue. And the guy, he really wasn't trying to hurt nobody, but he was trying, he hit the daddy to get away. And right next door to her was a barbershop. And the guys, as they was going to the barbershop, they saw what was going on, and they intervened. Like, what is you doing, man? You can't be doing this right on Grand River. They coming to see you, Seth. You know, they doing this is putting the neighbor back in the hood. You know, the work that Lauren was talking about earlier. This is the concept that they adopted. But the unique thing about it, if that was 2 years earlier, unfortunately, they may have jumped in that situation. Or they may have walked in the building and ignored it. But because of the environment that we was able to change, they policed their own community. Now, in overstanding the racial complexity of this city that we live in, this was a white family that had been attacked by black men. And it was black men that rescued her. They didn't see a white people. They saw human beings. And they felt so comfortable and so loved and so respected. After we cleaned them up, we conducted the interview. I mean, this is the, when we talk about transformation and the power of love and the power of peace, again, this is what we have to exhibit. And the most important story that I want to share with you, one day I'm driving and I'm at the corner and I'm mine is somewhere racing. I'm trying to get to my next meeting, and a young man that I knew and I really didn't like because some of his behavior just didn't sit well with me, he says, "Can you take me to the hospital?" I mean, what's wrong with you, man? You look pretty damn good. Like, man, I want to kill myself. You want to do what? I want to kill myself. I say, come on, get in the car with me. I know what that feeling feels like because I tried to kill myself before. And I had nobody I can go talk to. And when I got him in the car, we began to drive around. I took him to my meetings, then I took him to lunch. And he began to pour his heart out to me, saying, man, I'm 23 and I got 3 kids. I'm tired of selling dope. My granddaddy, the only man that I knew in my life that has been a father figure to me, he has cancer and he's about to die. And I don't know how to be a father to my own children. It really wasn't too much I could say to him besides lending my ear, besides showing him some love. And by the end of the day, he left out the bookstore and left my presence with a smile. That's what peace looks like. Peace. My bad. Any storytellers that are still here, we want to welcome you guys back up to the stage, as well as some of the Lauren. We're going to do a quick Q&A, some quick questions, not lectures. You know, quick question if you have any, maybe about 3. Can you walk up here to the front? Sure, yes.
Okay, so my parents lived in the same house on the northwest side for 45 years. They only moved to the suburbs in 2013 when they were the victims of a home invasion. And I feel like if I had had a Yusuf to call or something when that happened to them, or if they did, they might have stuck around. But they just felt so isolated and helpless. So what does someone do when that happens to them if you don't have a Yusuf you can call or somebody else that knows how to talk to people and is not afraid to help you?
I mean, the most important thing is there's things that happen in numerous communities. And unfortunately, many of us is in a position to address those things. There may be a Tafari or Yusuf or Lauren in another community. So here's an opportunity to invite those people in our communities not to come in to oppose, not to come in to invade, but to come organically to assist. And assist is to develop the mechanisms to how to organize within those communities. and to be able to assess where the pitfalls are and how we build up. And we may not address it immediately right there. We may begin to organize. Some people will call it a block club. But again, the most important thing is by letting folks know that you're not alone, by letting folks know that we can deal with this situation. Because once a self-defeating mentality begins to take root in our community, we're lost on multiple levels. So we can
open it. If anyone has a question they want to ask or a comment and you want to come up here to the mic,
you should come up to the front. Feel free. If you have a question or a comment.
Or want to share something about your own experience? Okay, and you can also just talk.
Okay. Thank you, all of you. What I want to, at our table, we came up with two, I think, important issues, and we're brilliant. One is mental illness and how that's not dealt with. And we see so much police brutality issues around generally young men. So there's a systemic racial issue that's not getting dealt with. And number two, and I brought this one up having been robbed a lot, the older I got, the more fearful I got. And when Lauren's talking about her parents, like, we didn't leave, but what's interesting about it is it changes you. So once you go through a violent crime, and the last time I was with a gun, you're changed. And so how do we, you guys, overcome the fear and become more brave to do some of what you're doing?
Yeah, how do we get to radical love if you've got that fear blocking you? You got suggestions back there?
There go the mic right there, bro.
Hello, my name is Bobby Pearson, and I was saying that talking with others and trying to find solutions and and trying to talk things out to better the situation.
Okay. Yes. I just want to piggyback on that. I think sometimes we are the fearful person, and sometimes we're the courageous person, and so we have to know why we need each other. Because we're not always able to, get the courage ourselves. Other times it's there for someone else.
Right here and right over
there. Hi, my name is Deborah Makahinde. Everybody calls me Miss O. I live over on Fenmore, right over by what used to be Northland. And I lived over there I moved there when I was 19. I'll be 65 next month. Some of the kids, when I moved over there when I was 19, were riding big wheels. And when I was bebopping and hitting the clubs and all of that, they would come and they would, talk to my mother about gardening, or she would fix some hot dogs and tell them about the good old days and things like that. I've lived there. I did leave and go away, came back, and those very little kids are now grown, young black males that are advertised in all forms of media as being violent, uncontrollable criminals. And they sell weed and probably other drugs down the street. And when I realized that I was becoming afraid to come home because of the various characters that might be in the street, on the porch, coming up and down the street to their home, I finally decided to confront that fear by going down there and saying to them straight up, I know what y'all doing. I don't necessarily agree with it, But as long as I can come home and these little babies out here that's playing are safe, and Pops across the street who's 80-something years old wants to be able to come out and sit on his porch, as long as you respect that and you are willing to extend protection to this block, then I'm cool with it. The moment it becomes out of hand in terms of gunplay, then I'm going to have Benny Napoleon and everybody else on your natural behind. So what we have to do is begin to deprogram our minds from the media and its representation of young black males. We have to take an alternative route in our brain and say, when I go into a gas station and a young brother is standing behind me, I say, oh, when I turn around, hey, how you doing today? Or if I accidentally bump into someone, excuse me. It's called extending respect and dignity. It's called understanding that they are walking around 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year as the poster boys for mass murder. It's understanding that kind of stress, whether it's deserved or not, is what they're living with in this society. And they need to have a feeling of opportunity, welcome, usefulness, just like you do. So my suggestion would be, check your own self first, okay, number one. And then the next time you see a black man, young black man, instead of grabbing your purse closer to you or trying to get into that macho stare down, say hello.
That's radical love.
For Yusuf and Lauren and Josh, I was wondering if you could share examples of, I guess, times that you've learned from other communities or just things that you've grown with from working across communities in Detroit.
I mean, for me, not only just across Detroit, but across the state and across the country, I've been fortunate enough to travel. And the most important thing, like I bring a large present, but for that present to be cultivated, I allow myself to be absorbed within that community, to hear the stories of the community, to hear the pain or whatever is going on in that community, that which instructs me how to assist in that community and not to come in as if I'm the savior, if I know anything, or the expert. I mean, in all actuality, we're all experts in some form, some fashion. So to really piggyback off the last question, have we pulled out the confidence within ourselves, the wherewithal to want to do this work versus continue to want to depend on a Yusuf or Tafari or Jane Doe? And because what happens is, well, if Yusuf doesn't do the work, then it won't get done. And in reality, we need more Yusufs than just Yusuf himself to be able to do this work. And so for that to happen, we have to be listening to other people. And this is how we learn. This is how we get better. And understanding what are the values that is governing the work that we're doing, and understanding the history, because it's a history to everything, and being willing to dig deep and have a root cause analysis behind what we're doing. A lot of the work that we're doing is funded by major corporations or major foundations. In reality, the work needs to be funded by ourselves. And that funding has to come out of our love. So the great equalizer to fear is love. You know, we think love is soft, but actually love is strong. Love is strong enough to keep us here and push us to do what we need to do.
I'll just be brief. I want to say I just learned today, so those words, radical love, and that concept of loving through the fear, when I'm in the neighborhood and people are talking about how they're afraid to. So there's a new coffee shop that's coming to 6 Mile, and we have meetings in it. She's not open yet. She needs her health inspections. So, but we have meetings in there, and to hear people talk about how they're afraid to come there because the negative element hangs out next door at the liquor store. What I want to take to the people in the neighborhood right now is, like, how about instead of you looking at that person as the negative element, see that person as a member of your community. Are you brave enough to radically love through your perception of that person? It's going to be challenging for some people. Black people have hold on to the same negative stereotypes about black men that white people do about black men. Like, we're as guilty. We're all programmed by the same thing. So what I'm taking away from this is I can't wait to get back in front of that group and be like, okay, can you love through that fear? Can you see that person as a community member that we left out? Can you take some responsibility for why they're in the position that they are? I don't know. I'm kind of excited to see what will happen. Also kind of scared. And it's something I've tried to do with my parents. So after, if you can imagine, so my parents were senior citizens. I feel like if they were younger, they might have stuck around after the home invasion. But a lot of the conversations I've been having with them are like, you know, the person that did that really needed something that he wasn't getting somewhere else. And don't look at black men as if they're all troubled now. But really, they think that all young black men are bad now. And I don't fault them for that because of what happened. But just trying to... Like, that's going to be the toughest audience to try to convert, right? Some people that have been the victims of some violence by a group of people. And just trying to get to people like that and teach radical love is, I don't know, it's like monumental, but I think it's really important.
I learned that getting down in our neighborhoods, in the hood, this is where it's most effective at. We can go out to events outside of the neighborhood and speak to people and go to different conferences and stuff. But getting down in the hood and dealing with the youth in our neighborhoods is how you really crack down on a lot of this stuff. A lot of these crimes and the stuff we've seen on the news, we don't have enough people coming to these neighborhoods, kicking it with these kids, you know what I'm saying, showing them that radical love. So we got to get deep down into the neighborhoods and start giving back, you know what I'm saying?
So we'll leave it ending on that note in terms of getting back and being rooted in our neighborhoods, as Josh kind of intertwined between hood and neighborhood. And the focal point should be building neighborhoods. And the key word is being a neighbor. If we're neighbors in our neighborhoods, then we're orchestrating everything that we said to be able to succeed. And understanding that these issues are not black issues. These are issues not prevalent to the black community. These are American problems as a result of systems of white supremacy, of capitalism, that create structures of exploitation and degrading human beings and put them in the positions of behaving like animals. And we must understand these dynamics. And understand these dynamics as human beings that love ourselves enough to be radical in our living. By being a radical neighbor of loving, like Lauren just said, despite my fear of you. Because that fear of you have of that young man or that young woman, they have probably the same fear in return. And we have to understand, like, this is not just a young and old. We have to have a holistic approach. Like, every person in our community is valuable. Like, for this event to take place, it needed Michigan Roundtable. It needed Michigan Radio. It wasn't about egos. It's about I mean, that is the biggest killer in any of this work that we're doing. This should not be about posturing. This should not be about positioning ourselves for money. This should be about positioning ourselves as saving lives. Peace.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. Thanks to Matrix for hosting us. Thanks to the roundtable for allowing us to come in here. I've really enjoyed all the discussion. The whole conversation will be available on our website, and there you will also be able to, April's going to put a link to the documentary that we did, much of which was reported right here in Osborne. So I hope you can find the time to listen. Thank you.